Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
And welcome everybody to Lost in the Static. Hi Josh, how you doing today?
What's up, Scott? See, we said each other's names to introduce each other because we're clever like that.
We can do that. And you know what?
What?
I was thinking the other day that I might like to stuff something up my butt.
Well, see, what you would do then, because you want to be safe about that kind of thing.
Of course.
So you'd go to adamandeve.com and buy whatever your butt stuffing would happen to be. And then at the end, use the promo code STATIC. And they would also give you a free mystery gift. They'd cover U.S. shipping. They'd give you 50% off your butt stuffing. And they would give you not one, not two, not four, but three DVDs for free.
One, two, five, three, sir. Three. There we go. Yes. And we've gotten our obligatory Monty Python reference in. So let's start this music. Or let's start this episode, rather, with some music, shall we?
Yes. Very 1972-ish music.
Was beautifully 70s.
Do any of you recognize that? That is not there can be only one. This is not Highlander. This is McLeod.
Yeah, but Highlander was the better McLeod.
Oh, easily. Okay. The reason we're doing this episode tonight, we're going to be talking about TV shows that if you didn't grow up with them,
it would be hard for you to believe they even existed.
Yeah, these are ones that you'd go, if I was describing this to a younger person, they'd go, what? And the reason this came up is Alex Jowski of Geek Juice Media is just now watching all of the Highlander movies for the very first time.
Right.
And so he's finally, I get on Mystery Science Theater every time they would go, McLeod! He thought they were referencing Highlanders, either Connor or Duncan McLeod.
Right, which I would have too to give him credit.
Fair enough, but those were references to McLeod from the 1972 TV series, which kicks off our bizarre run. It was, like I said, 72, lasted seven seasons. It was a cowboy cop in modern day New York. And I don't mean like time travel. He was a good old Texas cowboy, even riding a horse down Times Square. And he's chasing a guy on a motorcycle on a horse, and he jumps off and tackles the guy, and he's jumping on helicopters, but he's a cowboy.
Right.
That is so 70s that you'd never get that show made today, would you?
Well, no, probably not. And we got to remember that the 70s was also the decade of the CB and the cowboy trucker, and cowboys were kind of
great big convoy.
Yeah, and cowboys were kind of big. You also had Smokey and the Bandit in the 70s. BJ and the Bear, and all that Wild West cowboy theme kind of just rolled through everything, really.
To a degree, yeah.
To a degree. And there was some weird TV that came out of the 60s and 70s and 80s that, yeah,
it's almost indescribable to a degree.
Exactly. I was talking to somebody. I was talking to you the other day, and you mentioned GLOW.
Yes.
And that got me thinking. And we're not talking, you know, like the GLOW sticks or anything like
that. The gorgeous ladies of wrestling.
And I was trying to describe that to Dawn because she had never heard of it.
She didn't know. GLOW was first run syndication in the U.S. in the mid to late 80s. Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. Just listen to this. I'll give you a little history after this.
Definitely. And I won't won't subject you to any more verses of that one. But yeah, very, very, very 70s, or very 80s, rather, especially with the, you know,
the
that
hairstyles.
Was the dawn, the hairstyles, the dawn of rap being the in thing at the time.
Well, and also WWF was really ramping up. So, well, first of all, do you know who started GLOW?
Who started GLOW?
Sylvester Stallone's mom.
Seriously?
Yes. I'm not kidding. Sylvester Stallone's mom started GLOW and was their owner for the longest time, man. I'm not kidding.
Weird. Okay, I didn't know that.
But GLOW started off as just like a performance act. You know, like they went around the country and did shows and whatnot. And then they got picked up for a syndicated show, which was, okay, this is an era you got to remember. WWF was still pretending it was real. Remember that they were insisting they were not faked, they were not scripted, and this was all real wrestling?
Right.
GLOW was basically, I call bullshit on you. GLOW was, we are as fake as WWF, we're just going to play up that angle. These were so scripted, so choreographed, so intentionally goofy, and you had one of every GLOW girl. You had the cow, you had the down-home farm girl.
Amy.
You had the punk rock girl, which was Hollywood.
Yes.
And Vine. You had the real heavy metalers, which were heavy and metal.
Right.
And then you had like Big Mama Volcano or Big Mama Earthquake, which is the big Hawaiian fat one.
Yeah, Samoan, but yes.
Yeah. And then you had the black girl, and you know, each one, you had the Russian, because of course it's the 80s. You can't have the Russian.
You had the character of blah, whatever blah.
Whatever the stereotype was.
It was there.
And most people might know GLOW from Married with Children. They were featured prominently when Al had to go to Vegas because Peggy pawned Al's TV to get money to go to Vegas. And then Peggy and Marcy lost all of the money and Al and the kids had to rescue him. And to get the money to go back home, Al had to do a GLOW event and he got put into a coma where he was dribbling peas out of his nose in a wheelchair at the end.
Well, all right then.
So most people might know GLOW from the second half of the two-parter where the Bundys went to Vegas. But GLOW... just try to describe that to somebody today. It kind of works better with the visuals, and they'd go, this is like a Funny or Die sketch. No, this isn't real.
this is true. And like I said, I was trying to describe it to Dawn, and she was at the time, she was quite young, but she was really into the WWF and the WWWF, which is what it started out as. And she followed that for a long time, and she had never heard of GLOW. And I was like, well, it was kind of a spinoff, kind of, sort of.
It was kind of a parody than anything, really.
Yeah, yeah, that's...
And they're still around.
Are they really?
They don't have their TV show. It only lasted like 2 seasons.
Right, right.
But they still do live shows, and they got a regular Vegas show at one of the casinos. I don't remember which one. They still put out some DVDs on their website. GLOW still exists. It's just... way more underground now than it used to be.
Yeah, well, and let's be honest. It was, I remember it airing on TV, but it was always late at night.
Yeah,
us.
Well, you weren't in this market yet. In this market, it was always like 3 a.m. on Channel 11 on Friday or Saturday night.
Yeah, and I think it had a similar time slot where I was, but it was, you know, and I can kind of see why, because the outfits were skimpy as can be, and the skits
were a lot of sex jokes.
The skits
too.
Were a little racy, you know.
Yeah,
so.
And it wasn't just wrestling. They had skits in between each wrestling event that were, you know, obviously scripted and, you know, shot with multiple angles and stuff. And they were goofy and very sexual, very punny. Puns were a big thing on this show.
Oh yeah.
And yeah, it was a limited success. The fact that it still is going in 2014 says it was a success.
Yeah.
Almost 30 years.
Yes.
So that's something.
Who knows? I mean, it was fun and it was goofy, and I remember watching it and enjoying it. So,
but we were also at that puberty age where these are scantily clad women that are really hot with teased hair, throwing each other around a ring, getting sweaty. Yes.
I'm okay with this.
I am totally okay with this. So, now, this next one you brought up.
And we were talking about weird TV, and with me traveling a whole lot, you know, I get exposed to a lot of sometimes very strange international things. And this is one that Dawn and I actually enjoy. It's still on the air. It's been on the air since, I believe the late 70s.
I was
going
to say, you told me,
yeah,
I think you told me it was 70s.
Yeah, it's been around a long, long time. But I forget whether it's on Univision or Telemundo here in the U.S., but that is Sábado Gigante. And I tried explaining this to you, and you were like, okay.
I don't speak Spanish. So the thing he's about to play is from 1991, though. So it's very out of date to what might be on the air now.
A través de sus más de 500 estaciones afiliadas de costa a costa.
Coast to coast.
Y en 16 países de Centro y Suramérica. Sábado Gigante. Y para comenzar esta fiesta de los sábados, recibamos con un fuerte aplauso al animador y creador de este programa.
But I just want to, I wanted to say something about that open, what the people are not seeing.
Right.
And I don't mean this as an insult if it comes off like that. That's a very 700 Club opening. The graphic style they used, I'm like, wait a minute, this was always on the 700 Club when they were talking about how Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles were from the devil.
Well, no, I mean, it's what Sábado Gigante is a variety show on obviously most of Saturday on either Telemundo or Univision here in the States, and I forget which one again. But you have your host, and it is very, very Central and South American, and that is that the humor is extremely sexually charged. Relative to the U.S. because
it's kind of slapsticky too.
Well, it's very slapsticky. It's fun. There are a lot of jokes that you can get even though you don't speak the language.
A lot of visual jokes,
a lot of visual gags, and a lot of, you know, again, if you do speak Spanish, there are a lot of puns. There are a lot of sexual plays, but it's very, very strange because you'll go from like, here's our local. Here in New York, here's the Spanish Children's Church Choir, and they'll come out and they'll sing and they'll do their thing, and then we'll cut to a skit after that about three roommates, teenage slut roommates or something like that. And again, it's very Central and South American, where here in the States we see it as very sexually charged. Down there, it's just
normal.
It's the way it is. Trust me, if you ever get a chance to go to Rio, you'll be like, oh, okay, so this is what, you know, somebody, a sex positive society is.
We are a very sex negative society.
Yes, here. We are. And Sábado Gigante sees that it's a chance for people from Central and South America to get some of their humor and some of their stuff here in the U.S. And to the untrained eye, it is hilarious and it's fun. And there's always a midget and there's always sexy women. And
the staging actually reminded me a lot of like the Brady Bunch Adventure Hour, Funtime Adventure Hour, or even like Paul Lind or something like that. The tone it was giving off was of that.
It would be more like the celebrity variety. It would be closer probably to Sonny and Cher or the Smothers Brothers.
Okay.
Where you kind of have a host that it all rotates around, or in the case of the Smothers Brothers, two.
A duo.
But yeah, it's really strange because, like I said, you'll have a church choir singing at some point, and then all of a sudden, a midget dressed as Batman will come out and spank a sexy nurse. And that's how random it is.
Is this what Bumblebee Man and whatever show he's on The Simpsons?
Yes.
Is essentially a parody of?
Yes, it's Bumblebee.
Oy, muy bueno.
Yeah, it's definitely taken from Sábado Gigante.
Okay. And
even if you don't speak Spanish, if you can track down some clips online or something, it is
there was
just
a lot
fun.
When you Googled
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's just really fun to watch.
This next one is also yours.
Yes.
I do not remember. Somehow, okay, you know I love 70s TV. I love weird shit. I love the supernatural. I don't remember this one. So just play it before you explain it.
Okay.
So
out of
70s.
The great Northwest comes the legendary Bigfoot, who 8 years ago saved a young child lost in the vast wilderness and raised that child until he grew up to be Wild Boy.
Yes, Bigfoot and Wild Boy, and I remember, I don't remember it well, but I do remember this series.
Well, you know about the Bigfoot craze of the 70s,
right? Oh, yeah, when that film was released, et cetera, or when that...
The Legend of Boggy Creek was the film that kicked off the Bigfoot craze. And then after that, for those who didn't live in the 70s, it was Bigfoot crazy.
Until about 1982.
Yeah, I mean, Bigfoot would technically be the correct plural, though, wouldn't it?
No, Bigfoot describes feet. Bigfoot is the animal, so it would be Bigfoots.
But big plurals, big lower appendage plurals were everywhere. They were in TV, movie, books, comics, they were everywhere, man. And
if I remember right, there was a Superman Bigfoot crossover at some point.
Probably. That was on Super Friends.
I know damn well there was a Batman and Bigfoot crossover.
Probably on Super Friends.
No, in a comic series.
Oh, in the comics, maybe.
Just because I remember the covers. Because
70s DC is bleh, so yeah. I don't know.
Yes.
How long did this last? Do you happen to know?
Not very long. Like maybe a year. I don't know off the top of my head. Like I said, I don't really remember this one, but the intro, I saw it and I was like, aha, yes, I do remember.
That's one.
Yes, that's one.
And one we forgot to get the intro for, Man from Atlantis. Man from Atlantis is one of those weird ones that was, you know, obviously Atlantis was following, you know, the 70s hooey trend of, you know, Atlantis and UFOs and Big Feet and all that. But Man from Atlantis was a guy has gills and he washes up on shore and the government's trying to track him down and he's staying with his family while he's learning about humanity. You just kind of go, wow, 70s.
So it was like Aquaman, but not a superhero.
Kind of, yeah.
Did this come out about the same time as Splash?
Splash was 82. 283.
Yeah,
so.
Somewhere there.
Yeah, so. No, this is pre-Splash.
Because I know Splash kicked off a mermaid craze for a little while.
Well, and then you even have ones like we talked about before, but like Kolchak the Night Stalker. For 1975, I think that was. That, you know, okay, just think about it as I say it, how weird this sounds, okay? A newspaper reporter in Las Vegas discovers that a vampire is existing, and after he accidentally kills the vampire, he's run out of Las Vegas. So then he moves to Seattle, where he finds an immortal is killing prostitutes for their blood. He kills the guy and then is exiled to Chicago, where every week he runs across an alien or a time traveler or a devil or a clone or a zombie. That, for the mid-70s, was kind of weird, wasn't it, when I say it out loud like that?
Yeah. Yes. And it
Kolchak was really good, though, because it was really well written. That was its strongest point, is they really sold this shit.
Okay.
So it wasn't goofy.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I think it would have been lost to obscurity. The reason it hung on was it wasn't goofy. But it's still weird.
Yeah, that's a little odd to describe.
In the post-X-Files era, though, people go, yeah, and? But pre-X-Files... You know, I mean, hell, I can't even imagine what Chris Carter went through to pitch the X-Files in 92. Cause, you know, think about...
It makes me wonder if he didn't go, hey, remember Kolchak the Night Stalker?
Oh, no, he clearly based that on... When Darren McGavin even appeared on the X-Files in, like, the fourth or fifth season, he wanted him to be Kolchak.
Okay.
But Darren was like, I've left that, you know, that role as an old... I'll be on the show. But I don't want to be Carl Kolchak. I want to be a different character.
Okay.
But he wanted to bring Kolchak back on the X-Files to even link continuities, which would have been pretty fucking cool, really.
And had they linked, I'm sure they would have led back to St. Elsewhere, both of them.
Well, because X-Files is connected to St. Elsewhere, so it would have pulled Kolchak into that then. But then, like one I was showing you, and you were getting being driven nuts by trying to figure out the technical aspects of what some of this stuff was. The Highwayman from 87 was obviously following the Road Warrior craze, but it wasn't set in a post-apocalyptic world. It was set in the near future. They never told you what year it was set in. And the police are overwhelmed or so universally corrupt that they have the government has deputized certain people that just travel the country as highwaymen, bringing justice where it is needed. Starring Sam Jones and Jane Balder after V, Sam Jones after Flash Gordon, and Tim Russ long before Star Trek Voyager. Play the open, and then we'll talk a little bit about some of the interesting stuff I showed you about this.
You got it.
They say he came into this world from someplace off the clock. That his mother was an ice cold wind, his paw a fiery rock. It's told that on some starless nights his rig could up and glow, and folks who say they saw it coming swear they didn't see it go. Now you hear a lot of legends told when you ride the long, hard slab, of some who say the man is good and some who say he's bad. But all agree who've ever tried to play a cheating hand, you only get one chance to draw against the Highwayman.
Ah, yes.
You can see the very Road Warrior style, oh, yeah. yet near future tone they were going for, can't now, you?
Yes, and I want to talk about the visuals on this one real quick, because the big selling point of Highwayman, just like Knight Rider, the big selling point Kit. Was Kit, and
Auto Man was the car, the helicopter, the tank, whatever right, he was,
whatever
that
he
week.
Wanted to become, and stuff like that. You had a lot of shows that went. Here's the really Blue Thunder, the movie. Yeah. Here's it's a helicopter.
Airwolf, the TV series.
Yeah, Airwolf, there we go. You had that big selling point of technology. Now, Highwayman's big selling point was the semi, which is, I was looking at this, and it's very bizarre because it's in two distinct parts of the tractor and the trailer.
Right.
And then suddenly.
And there's a reason for that.
Suddenly he would stop and. It would turn into, like the cab would become a helicopter, but it would become one solid piece of helicopter. So you knew when they transformed that they, of course, they were perfectly straight and lined up because there was a solid body helicopter hidden in there.
Yeah. Somebody found the original rig that they used after the show tanked for whatever reason. Somebody, you know, they got rid of it and somebody found like the chassis and all that and built it back up. They found it at a junkyard, and they've completely restored it to what it looked like on the show.
Oh, cool.
And they take it to car shows and shit like that now. But basically, the Highwayman's vehicle, yeah, if he got into trouble, he could leave the rig behind, and the cab turned into a helicopter. And Scott's like, three blades. Okay, that's European. And he's sitting here analyzing it. Well, that could be French. Well, it could be British.
No, you it's know. French. It's a French helicopter. I forget. It starts with an A, and it's an extremely popular one, and I know you'd the tail rotor was built into the tail is the big selling deal, and it's got this kind of swoopy bubbly front, and it's a French helicopter. I forget exactly what kind it is, but yeah, I do that. I'm like, okay,
what is that?
I look at Airwolf and people go, that's Airwolf, and I go, no, that's a Bell
whatever
490 or something like that. But it's a Bell helicopter with some cosmetic changes on it.
Coolest part of Highwayman, and the most confusing for us as kids because we didn't know some of the background, Sam Jones, most of us know him as Flash Gordon.
Yes.
And in the newer generation, we'll know him as Flash Gordon from the Ted, you know, nonsense.
Yes.
Well, in Flash Gordon, he was dubbed by another actor. So we did not hear one single word that was Sam Jones' voice. So when we saw him on Highwayman, we're like, that No, that's not what he sounds like. It was the first time we were hearing his actual voice.
Right.
We're like, no, that's wrong.
Of course.
In fact, it's the other way around. It's Flash Gordon that was wrong.
This is true. And speaking of Flash Gordon and dubbing, is it just me or would you love the world if just for one day all TV shows, all voices on all TV shows were dubbed by Brian Blessed?
Brian Blessed can make anything cool.
Yes,
Gordon's alive? Brian Blessed makes anything cool.
This is true.
Highwayman lasted only like 11 episodes, and they were 50-50. Some were good, some were awful. The biggest thing that if this ever would come out to DVD, that would be the selling point is how many not famous people were on the show that are famous now.
Right.
The guest cast list is almost all up-and-comers, that people you go, oh, they're a really big name now. In 87, this is like their second
bit part. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that if this ever comes to DVD, that'll be the selling point is, we've got all these big actors who you won't even recognize because they're like 20 years old now in this.
Yeah, and it's I always love cast lists like that because it's really surprising what you can find.
Oh, just look any episode of Hill Street Blues. And you'll find the guest cast is somebody who was not famous then and is now because of just the way they shot that show.
Now, let's jump decades again.
Okay.
And you brought this. And I kind of remember this show, but I kind of don't. And you brought it
There's
to my
a reason
attention.
You kind of don't. I'll get into that in a minute.
Okay. And this, well, I'll just play the intro.
Yeah. Here we go.
Very, very 90s industrial intro there, but I love it. I like it.
I also like the tagline, what you search for, what you don't know might, I don't know, I fucked it up and I just heard it.
What you don't know might hurt you, but what you search for might get you.
Yeah. And Freaky Links, the reason you might not remember it is there were 13 episodes that took 2 years to air.
Yeah, Yeah,
that's partial because see, Fox aired 5 episodes out of order, by the way, too. Even though it's a continuity based series,
Fox air something that's continuity based out of order. That would never happen, Firefly, ever.
Yeah, well, this was so bad that like the fourth episode that aired,
right,
was clearly supposed to be about the sixth episode because they're referring to events that would happen 2 weeks later in episodes. You're going, God damn it! But say they canceled it after 5 episodes. A letter writing campaign got them to bring it back because it was, like I said, all 13 had already been shot. So Fox is sitting on these extra episodes.
Right.
So then they aired 4 more, and you know, about 6 months later, ratings were still terrible. So they canceled it again. Another letter writing campaign got them to finally burn the last 4 episodes off over summer. So this show was technically canceled 3 times within 13 episodes.
That's sad.
Kind of a record in a strange way, but.
Now, was it any good?
Yes, it was very good. The actual
so wait a
stories...
minute. Wait a minute. So wait a minute. Fox took a very good series.
Wrecked it.
Aired it out of order. Killed it. That would never, ever happen today, Firefly. Ever. Ever.
Not letting the Firefly thing go, huh?
I am not. I am a brown coat to the core. I want my cat Mal back.
And in all honesty, you know, what they did to Firefly, they did to Freaky Links first.
Yeah, I believe.
In all honesty, except Firefly, they didn't even burn off the unaireds. Those, I got off of a bootleg off of a British airings, but
and
most,
they're on the DVD
most people
set
saw
now.
Them
yeah.
on the DVD for the first time.
Now, is Freaky Links on DVD?
No. No, Freaky Links is not. And Freaky Links was unique in the fact that if you see them in order, it tells a full story. The reason that I'm putting it into the weird category is this was the first horror series that was really tied to the internet, both off the show and on the show. Because Ethan Embry runs a website called freakylinks.com where he looks for freaky links. You know, the goofy shit. You got to remember, this is created by the Blair Witch people, so half the show is handheld.
Right.
But it's the characters of what they're shooting. So it makes sense why it's handheld, not randomly handheld footage, you know, and then studio shot footage. But the thing about it was that the FreakyLinks.com that he runs was actually FreakyLinks.com, which was run by Fox at the time, and it linked to the real website. So the stories you saw on the show, you could go see more footage and actual write-ups as if it were a real website, not for a TV show.
Interesting.
And for a while, you just typed it in, and it's gone now. Somebody, some fan, bought FreakyLinks.com and actually ported over the website, which you can probably find. The Wayback Machine probably has the old FreakyLinks, the Fox version.
Now it belongs to NA Media, which is they're a well-known company for taking popular links and sitting on them or pre-registering names that they're sure are going to be popular.
I've talked about those on What the Fuck, what we call those hostage domains.
Yep, and that's how they make their living.
Yeah, they're scumbags. But the thing with FreakyLinks was, in the show, this was the first time the computer was linked to the supernatural. Because he finding all these things and putting them online, as Dennis Christopher has a line in the pilot, the website, it's stirring them up. That is just weird. The website is pissing off the ghosts that it's reporting on. That's both cool and weird, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's it's a brilliant idea, and I wish, I mean, you know, they've taken it since then and run with it. You've got a lot of shows that take place on the internet, and it's like, this is real, and we're going to shoot it as if it's real. We're going to upload it if it's, you know, some of the Slender Man mythos and things like Marble Hornets, where it's the way that it's shot. And then you had things that were linked to District 9. You had some websites, and then, like I say, I forget what media it was linked to, but I Love Bees was one.
Yeah, you told me about that one. Yeah. See, what I should do is loan you my DVD set, my homemade set from My Airings. I put the episodes in the correct order, by the way, too.
Good.
So the only thing that's fucked up on mine is the preview for next week is rarely telling you about what the actual next episode on my set is, because I put them in the order that they take place, not the order that they aired. Fucking Fox.
Well, you know, that's Fox. What are you going to do?
But yeah, Freaky Links is a very good series, very weird though, but just try describing that to somebody. Hey, it's a series, it's a horror series about the internet, where the internet is actually integral to the horror.
Now, Wipe, America, fuck yeah, the police force or whatever.
Team America.
Yeah, Team America. Wipe that from your memory. And let's.
I hate that, so it's not difficult.
Okay, let's go back to the 70s and 80s. And I happened to catch this on PBS here in the States.
I don't remember what channel it was. I do remember it was Sunday mornings here.
Right, but
I don't remember the channel.
It was syndicated. This is a British series that was insanely popular in Britain.
And who's the guy that produced these? Because he did a bunch of these. What was his fucking name? He also did his first total live action one in the 90s was Space Precinct.
Right.
Remember that?
Right.
God, the guy's name is just falling out of my fucking head. But yeah, he did a ton of these.
But this one in particular really took off in the UK. And I remember living in the UK and talking to people about it. And they're like, of course we remember this. And you know, being here in the States, you mention it and people are like, oh yeah, that was the puppet one. So these are it's a show starring marionettes,
yep,
and very talented voice actors. And the intro went a little something like this.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Thunderbirds are go.
But yes, that infamous and very foreboding 5-4.
I never saw the live action movie that Bill Paxton directed in the early 2000s that won a ton of Razzies, so it must be really, really good. I don't know if that used any of this or if it was just a complete rape of the franchise or not.
It was a complete rape of the franchise, and it was terrible.
I love Bill Paxton. I don't know how he directed that, you know?
I don't know, but it was bad.
Okay, I saw the trailer and went, nope, not doing this. Nope, can't make me.
But this was the story of the Tracy family, and they happen to have, again, this is that 70s and 80s, toy in this case for kids toyetic selling
remember
point.
Them. I don't remember toys for these. At least here, I do not remember Thunderbirds
now,
toys.
I don't think they really took off here. But again, when I was living in the UK, I found toys for them still all over the place, and I was happy. And in fact, I have, well, it's packed away or something, but I have all of the Thunderbird vehicles.
Okay.
In like Matchbox scale, so.
And then, like I said, they made a bunch of these. In fact, we've never seen them, I guess, unless we were watching Minneapolis Public Access Television or KTMA back in like 88. The very first two episodes of Mystery Science Theater, the two that no copies have ever shown back up of, were Thunderbirds, the episodes edited together as movies.
Oh, okay. Well, that'd be interesting to see.
Yeah, and we've never seen those, obviously, unless we were watching Minneapolis KTMA back in 1988 for those first 2 weeks.
Which I was not.
Yeah, because any of us were. Come on, what are you thinking here, dude? None of us were.
Yeah. But yeah, trying to explain Thunderbirds now, especially to...
In the CGI era, it seems... so unnecessarily complex, doesn't it? On how they did it?
It seems unnecessarily complex. And then if you look at the episodes and you can clearly see the strings, they weren't hiding. They didn't try to shoot them. I almost have to hand it to the directors because...
You're saying fuck it?
Well, because you go, okay, this is the shot I want and we can build the models and do it. And then you have the puppeteers go, but you'll see the strings. You almost have to hand it to the directors to go,
So
this is the shot I want. This is the good shot. If we shoot it to hide the strings, we're going to sacrifice a vision.
By the way, it is really bothering me that I cannot think of the producer of this.
I apologize. I hang on. I'll tell you what. You,
I'm gonna talk while
you talk
this
a little
out.
Bit, and I'm gonna.
It is really fucking bothering me, Scott. This is just eating at me that it's like, and when you do find it, I'm going to go, God damn it, of fucking course. But yeah, like I said, he did a ton of these. I believe his first and only live action TV series was Space Precinct in 92, maybe something like that. I think 1992. Gary Anderson, Jerry Anderson, God damn it. God damn
turn
it.
Turn my mic back up. That generally helps. Yeah. That's it.
As soon as I knew it, I was going to go, fucking stupid, Josh.
Space Precinct is another one that you have a hard time describing to people exactly what the hell was going on.
I'll describe it. You find the open.
Okay.
Space Precinct basically was an NYPD cop gets accidentally transferred, and this takes place in the 90s still, to... the other side of the galaxy where a bunch of aliens are on a space station and he becomes the first human cop in the space precinct. I'm not kidding. This was a real show that lasted 26 episodes. I own the DVDs. You know, I own the DVD. This is real, man.
Yeah, I remember this, but it was like Space Precinct 2040, wasn't it?
In some places, yeah.
Yeah, it went like this. Whoops. Actually, it goes much better if I have the YouTube volume turned up.
Derp.
The name's Brogan. Lieutenant Brogan. For 20 years, I was with the NYPD. Now,
Well, let's just say I've transferred to another precinct.
And yeah, he's on a space station, and there's puppets. They don't do the marionettes. It's heavy makeup and whatnot. And this ran in first-run syndication here in the U.S.
And it is definitely one of those shows that is the king of cheese.
It's fun, though. I mean, in all honesty.
It's fun. They're not...
They're not... Okay, here's...
They're not... It's not good TV.
It's not deep art, but it's also not... Honestly, this is the true way I can put it. It's as good as your average 90s cop show. Yeah. Not like an NYPD Blue or something. An average cop show, it's about as good as that. The stories are predictable, and they take the same tropes, but they're not unenjoyable.
That's true. Before we move on, while we're kind of on kids and puppets and stuff like that, I'm going to take an entire production studio, and I'm going to lump them all together.
Because they kind of were...
Because they were all nuts. Every single show that they put out
was... Sid and Marty Croft.
Anything by Sid and Marty Croft. And I'm talking Land of the Lost. I'm talking...
The Sid and Marty Croft stuff, let's face it, really was for people that were high.
H.R. Puffin stuff.
Lidsville.
Yes, it's... Yeah.
The Banana Splits?
Yes.
This was for stoners. Stoners yes. watched Sid and Marty Croft, dude.
But it was fun. It was more. I loved the Banana Splits when I was younger.
I caught some of them on Boomerang.
They're not as good now. They don't hold up at all.
Oh wow! Yeah. I wasn't even high, but was I high?
Yeah,
yeah. And then we got a couple that you didn't remember that I'm like, oh, you need to find these, like Otherworld. This one was really unique, but also ungodly expensive, hence why it's only lasted 8 episodes.
Right.
Other worlds lie outside our seeing, beyond the beyond, at the edge of within. The Great Pyramid, erected by the Ancient Ones as a barricade at the portal between two dimensions, two separate realities. This is the story of one family drawn through a mysterious vortex into the other world, and of their perilous trek homeward.
Jonathan Banks as the villain.
Gloriously 70s synth sound effects.
For 1986.
Well, I know, but they were gloriously 70s synth sound effects, even if it was 1986.
This one, just listen to the description I'm going to give, and you'll go, wow, that'd never get greenlit today. A family is visiting Egypt, and while they're inside one of the pyramids, light hits a certain, you know, alignment of, you know, the moon and the sun and all that, and they get transported to a dystopian other world, where they find out that there are other pyramids like this. And then so Jonathan Banks is running this, he's running like the police force of this dystopian world, and he's chasing them. And every episode they would, you know, hit one of the pyramids and go to a completely, one episode might be a road wire knockoff. The next episode might be a complete hippie world or whatnot. And it was really unique in the fact that every episode was different, but there was a running thread. They were not the first people to go there.
Ah.
For instance, they find American money from the 70s on the cowboy world and things like that. And they're like, so we're not the only people that are traveling like this trying to get home. And, you know, it had a lot of potential. And it was also really, really expensive. And so low ratings did not help it.
Well, yeah, I can only imagine, especially since you have to, I'm just from a production standpoint going, okay, this episode we're going to
spend all this money
for one episode,
and then we're never going to see that one again.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very expensive show.
And this one you brought to my attention, this is from 1986 and 87. Speaking of time traveling and the people in the weird world. Now, 70s, you take a contemporary family and you throw them into strange worlds. the '70s also played with, in the '70s and the '80s also played with taking characters from our past and throwing them into the modern world.
The fish out of water. Now this intro is a little bit longer, but you got to hear the whole thing to really make it fit. I think we played it on the show a long time ago.
A while back, yes.
Sheriff Jonathan Grail was mad. We'd hit a bank in his town. Arlen Pike. Me, Wolfson Lucas. William Pike. And Isaiah Ice McAdams. Known collectively as the Pike Gang. Grail had once been partners in crime with the four of us, but now all bets were off. The showdown was interrupted, however, by the Almighty, who sent us all sailing into the 20th century. And what a century it is. But we weren't what you'd call ordinary men, so we dug in, tried to adapt, and started a detection agency to put beans on the table.
Then there you go.
So, Outlaws. This was... five wanted criminals and the sheriff that used to work with them from 1889 that get zapped into 1986, and they become PIs. So they're fish out of water cowboys from the good old days in 1986 getting PI work, and it was fun, man. Come on, you tell me that. But as fun as that sounds, you tell me that would ever be greenlit post 1999.
No, probably not.
On a network?
No.
You know, what was it about the 80s that said, you know what, we'll give this a try?
Well, 70s and 80s doing the we'll give this a try stuff. Again, to me, I think that the real big difference was competition. There wasn't as much.
There was three channels, four if you count PBS.
Or five once Fox came in, or an independent or something like that. And the truth be known, there was a lot more money in television in the 70s and 80s than there is today.
Also, ratings numbers are very different because, like, even an Outlaws episode would get, like, an 11 share back then.
Which would be just incredible.
Yeah. NCIS is the highest rated show on TV right now. They get a 13, and they're a hit. Outlaws was a failure at an 11 share. That right. Shows just how much it's changed.
It's really just, again, spread out through all of the cable channels.
And now
the internet and YouTube, where you have people like PewDiePie and channels like him or the Cynical Brit and such having 28 million views. Or in the case of PewDiePie, I think he's up to 28 million subscribers. And if I had numbers like that, I'd be like, okay, bros, because that's what he's Swedish. So we're all bros.
I've only seen one episode of his, and that was from the video game that we did the voices for.
And you'd never want to see him again.
He's fucking terrible.
But nonetheless, I actually enjoy his shows. But nonetheless, if I were in his deal, I'd be like, okay, in order to help me, could each of my subscribers please send me $1 per year? How awesome would that be?
Yeah.
I'd be happy if all of our listeners sent us a dollar a year.
I know he's a millionaire just based on ad revenue.
Right.
So,
right.
Which is a little sticks in my craw, but that's a topic for another time.
That's a topic for another show.
I don't want to run out of time before we talk about this next one. We don't have the opening because it's longer, and Scott and I made fun of it brutally. But just listen to this promo, okay? This was a real show, 85.
They're coming in an all-new comedy misadventure.
Just cooking up a little witch's brew. There's dead things in there. Only a couple.
There's something funny going on in Shadow Chasers. Catch the special two-hour premiere Thursday, November 14th.
You'll love it!
There we go.
Shadow Chasers.
Now,
do you know who produced Shadow Chasers?
No.
Brian Grazer. you know, Ron Howard's producing partner. This was his first foray.
Oh, okay.
And the thing that makes Shadow Chasers so unique was it was basically like, what if Indiana Jones and Ghostbusters fucked behind a dumpster and had an illegitimate child?
I was going to say, this was November 1985, so this was post-Ghostbusters.
Yes.
Just.
Yes, just right after Ghostbusters.
So that there's your inspiration for it. But yeah.
But Shadow Chasers set a record.
How so?
This set a ratings record that, even though what we just talked about might be different now numbers-wise, but it was the lowest rated show of all time at that point on the networks. I mean, we're talking national, so not local shows or anything like that. There were 98 shows in 1985 for the networks.
Right.
Shadow Chasers was number 98 for all six episodes. So basically, nobody fucking watched Shadow Chasers in 1985 on ABC.
Wow.
It was one of those, no one cares.
And it's an interesting... It reminds me of, you're familiar with the cartoon The Real Ghostbusters, whatever it was.
The Real Ghostbusters was the ones based on the movie. The Filmation ones are the ones.
Ghostbusters, which are the originals. I'm talking about. This is it kind of reminded me of a live action version of that.
There was a live action version of that.
I know, but I'm.
I see what you're saying, and you're not wrong, except this was. Shadow Chasers was more played for comedy. As you heard, you know, there's something funny going on.
Right.
We're going to take ghosts and ghoulies and artifact hunting, but it's definitely played for laughs. Not slapsticky, but, you know, the character interactions. And I think that's probably why it didn't work, because the show wasn't too that bad, really.
I don't know. I'll have to see if there are some full episodes on YouTube, and I'll check them out.
Yeah, they weren't bad. They just, for some reason, no one watched them.
I mean, this is obviously a show that never bothered to get an alternate media release of any kind.
No, so, but only bootlegs exist.
Well, there you go.
Of like the six episodes. So I just wanted to, honestly, I wanted to talk about GLOW. That's the reason I brought this topic up to you.
And we discovered all this other cool stuff while we were...
Well, because, I mean, I actually feel like we grew up in a different era. Sometimes I feel like all of the younger viewers who only know this stuff from YouTube or from people going, oh, this is so bad, you gotta see it. We were watching GLOW going, this is awesome. We weren't going, this is so cheesy.
We grew up in a time when there was high budget experimentation going on. There's still tons of experimentation, especially online. I mentioned Marble Hornets and stuff like that. So there's still plenty of experimental media out there. But we grew up in a time where, since there wasn't much competition, a company could sink a good chunk of money and make a high production cost experimentation or an experiment to put on the air to see if it flew. And if it flew, they made their money back.
Max Headroom would never be greenlit today.
Right.
And that was $1 million an episode in 1987.
Right.
That's, you know, most shows today don't even have that per episode. And they get better ratings.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the networks are not willing to experiment. You know what actually caused the great experimentation?
Meh.
Low ratings. ABC created Max Headroom, Cagney and Lacey with CBS, but Max Headroom and China Beach and, you know, some of their most popular quality shows, because they were in fourth place.
Sure.
They had no other choice. There was like, what do we got to lose?
I want to take just a couple of minutes. Let's mention the low budget fun stuff that was out there that's hard to explain. One that we caught on PBS, Slim Goodbody.
That creepy motherfucker.
Yeah, he wore a bodysuit that showed where his organs were. And
he always creeped me out.
And he creeped me out, too, because he was...
creepy.
He seems like the kind of guy that got to know the bodies of the kids that helped him.
You know what? He reminds me a lot of Richard Simmons. I don't know if that's an insult or not, but he's got a very Richard Simmons build and the hair. And
yes.
He's very Richard Simmons-y.
Yes, only not nearly as flamboyantly gay. And... things like Zoom and stuff. We'll talk about that in a future episode of the weird kid stuff. But I hope you enjoyed it. And thanks a lot for joining us this week. Josh, where can they find us?
Go to 1201beyond.com and buy a t-shirt. buy a couple of t-shirts and also use the Amazon links. Yes, I just said that. Use the Amazon links at 1201beyond.com.
Bye, everybody. Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.